Yeah, I was a merman. I mean, I like to swim and all. I'm not half bad at it either. There was this lake near... Aaron chuckles despite himself. Weirdo. Now that, yeah. I thought I was a weirdo before. Often, actually. Aaron finally looks at me. Have you ever thought you were... bad? It sounds like such a simple question. I know it should have a simple answer. But Aaron and I both know it's not that simple. I mean, we play pranks on people. I think that's probably not upstanding citizen good, I say, Mom's refrain of using my powers for good once again pushing its way into my mind. No, but I mean really bad, Aaron says, looking back down at the floor. My dream washes over me. The one I have practically every night, but try not to let myself remember during the daytime. The one in the store, surrounded by food lined up on the shelves. The room is dark. I'm alone. And even though I have no idea why, I know beyond a doubt that it's my fault I'm there. I think I did something bad once. I say it before I know I'm saying it. It's like I'm hearing myself talk from across the room. You don't know? Aaron asks, looking hard at me now, searching me for a lie. I don't remember, I say, a truth I've never admitted to anyone before. It's just this dream I have. It changes sometimes, but I always wind up in the same place. Like I was put there or something. So how do you know you did something wrong? Aaron asks. I think about it for a minute, and when my brain quiets to a whisper, all I hear is my grandmother's voice. You stop that wandering, or one day you won't make it home. Because sometimes I go where I'm not supposed to, I say. Sometimes I go too far. Now we're both looking out the window, and I wonder what Aaron's bad dreams look like, if he feels as alone in his as I do in mine. I don't think just because you do bad things, it makes you a bad person, Aaron says, after a long stretch of silence. All of a sudden, it occurs to me that I still haven't found out why Aaron was so weird about the Golden Apple amusement park last month. My mind is racing with thoughts of a prank gone awry. Could Aaron have done something to the roller coaster that made it crash? But I stop myself before I get too far. Pulling a prank is one thing, but bringing down a roller coaster at 9 years old? It's not possible. But if he's not talking about that, then what is he talking about? What does make a person bad, then? I ask. Aaron shoves his hands in his pockets, like he's embarrassed. Then, so quietly, I can barely hear him, he says, being happy when bad things happen. I watch Aaron's face for any clues into what he could mean. But his expression is as flat as his tone. Then he looks at me and smiles, and it's the old Aaron again. The one who planned a mission just for me to get a sign with my name on it, who carved a safe path through the town of Ravenbrooks just so I could get home safely with a 2x2 foot tin treasure. He's my friend. An actual friend. Whatever he did, or thinks he did, I've got his back. I'm hungry, I say. Let's go get some tacos. Chapter 9. That night, I lie in bed waiting for sleep to come, but my stomach is churning. I don't know if it's the tacos or the fact that my conversation with Aaron brought my brain back to the Golden Apple amusement park, I just can't seem to stop imagining what it was like when that roller coaster car went rocketing off the tracks into a tree. I must be the only 12-year-old in the world who keeps a newspaper clipping of a tragic accident by his bed. It's become a habit to reread the same half article at night, skimming it for clues I may have missed before. I haven't had a good excuse to get back to the library at the university since I hitched a ride with Mom last time, so the second half of the story is still a mystery. Maybe I'm waiting for it all to make sense. Maybe I don't actually want to know how the story ends. I think about how scared that little girl must have felt, what the other people on the roller coaster thought when it detached, if they even knew or just kept rolling along, wondering what everyone was screaming about. I think about what my parents would have done if it was me. The only time I've ever seen my mom cry was when Grandma died. I wonder if she'd cry that hard if I died like Lucy Yee. I've just accepted the reality that I'm probably gonna throw up when a scream cracks the night and launches me from my bed. I rush to the window and press my forehead against the glass, looking for what could have made such an anguished sound. It came from across the street. I'm positive of that. And though it sounds totally nuts, I'd swear it sounded like Aaron's voice. I've never heard him scream, and anyway, what would make him do that at 2 in the morning? But there was something in the tail end of that wail that sounded so familiar. I stare out the window for so long that my breath starts to fog the glass. Nothing follows that one unearthly sound but a swath of silence, not even pierced by a yowling cat or skittering leaf. Maybe I did fall asleep, I tell myself. I'd been so wrapped up in thoughts of morbid accidents and crying moms that I dreamt the scream. I'm not satisfied with that answer, but my stomach is starting to churn again, and I'm getting sweaty with my breath bouncing off the window onto my face. I open the window to get a little fresh air, and the silence of the night is once again interrupted, this time by the faint but undeniable sound of music. Ice cream truck music. Across the street, light glows from the crack under the Petersons' boarded-up basement door. I start to have flashbacks of that night I eavesdropped on the side of Aaron's house, the night Mr. Peterson lurked outside my window in wordless warning. But a memory more powerful than that is driving me now. The memory of that scream that woke me up, but somehow didn't stir the rest of the neighborhood, just like the music doesn't. I fight back the voice of logic begging me to stay in my room and not pop the screen from the window frame. The trellis is beginning to get rickety from all this climbing, but I don't care about that now. All I care about is getting close to the Petersons' house. Maybe I can just get a sign from Aaron that everything is okay, that whatever is going on in his basement is totally innocent. The drilling, the music, the screams, they're all just what? A play rehearsal? A murder mystery party? All just some comical misunderstanding invented by the short kid across the street with the grubby shoes? The dew from Aaron's lawn soaks my feet, and I stand underneath his window, the crooked oak tree releasing tiny droplets onto my head. I scour the yard for a small pebble to chuck at Aaron's window, and after a few failed attempts, I land one right on the glass. I flinch at the sound, then wait for him to wake up and tell me to leave him alone. Nothing would be more comforting right now. Instead, Aaron's room remains dark, and the music from the basement cuts in and out like skips on a record player, setting my nerves further on edge. "Come on," I plead with Aaron under my breath, giving his window one more try, but this time I throw the pebble a little too hard, and instead of a pinging sound, I hear a pop, then a crack, and I realize with horror that I've splintered Aaron's window. The music in the basement cuts off, and the footsteps don't just fall evenly on the stairs like they did last time. Now, they pound up the steps, thundering the shortest warning before the jingling of keys signals the furious unlocking of the deadbolts securing the door. Frantic, I realize that this time I won't have a chance to get across the street undetected. The house offers no place to hide, no bush for cover or garage for shelter. The only place to go is the backyard. I regain movement and bolt for the backyard with the kind of adrenaline you hear about in moments of crisis. Evidently, I have more power in my skinny legs than I realized. I lunge for the only cover I can see, a pair of oak trees directly behind the house that make for the worst hiding place ever, but I don't have a choice because the keys are rattling faster now, and the door is starting to move from its frame. Just as I pull myself behind the trunk, a loud bang on the basement door makes my heart catch in my throat. I peer through the leaves and realize that one lock is still in place, and rather than patiently unlock it, whoever is behind the door has given up trying and is instead throwing himself against the wooden door. Flinching with each violent knock, I watch as the door bends behind the weight of the attack, the tiny crackling of splintering wood sending a chill through my paralyzed body. With one more vicious thrust, the last stubborn lock falls to the grass, and a hulking Mr. Peterson falls through the doorway, red-faced and sweating, with a foam of white spittle gathering in the corners of his mouth. I hang on to the trunk of the oak tree and plead silently with my heart to stop pounding, for fear that the animal that has taken over Mr. Peterson will hear it with his supersonic hearing. I'm quaking so hard, I can see the leaves above me trembling, and I pray not a single leaf drops. I watch in terror as Mr. Peterson skulks across the yard in search of the sound that interrupted his work. I can hear him panting from here, and I begin to think the craziest thoughts. How my last meal will have been tacos. How disappointed Mom will be in me for using my powers for eavesdropping. How I'll never have gotten to test out my audio manipulator. How, through this entire horrific episode, through the drilling and the window breaking and the door destroying, Aaron and his family have managed to stay quietly tucked into their beds, unaware that the boy across the street is about to be annihilated by their psycho dad. I watch as Mr. Peterson crouches to the grass and examines what I can only guess are the footprints I left in the dew. And that's when I notice that there's a grave. Well, I'm not sure it's really a grave because there isn't a dead body in it, but it definitely looks like a grave. Mr. Peterson stands slowly, tromping his way across the lawn, and now his demeanor has calmed a bit, as though the animal inside him has been suddenly tamed. He picks up the shovel and starts filling in the grave, even though I swear there's nothing in there. Just an empty, grave-shaped hole that I assume he buries trespassers like me in. 10 minutes pass, then 20, then 30, as my legs feel weaker and weaker. Suddenly I come back to my senses as the shoveling stops and Mr. Peterson steps to the sidewalk and then to the middle of the street, staring up at the window to my room, looking for signs of life there instead of behind him in his own tree. I swallow to wet my dry throat but it's no use. I've sweat every ounce of moisture from my body. I'd pee my pants if I wasn't already as dry as a desert. Then, just like last time, Mr. Peterson satisfies whatever compulsion he had in staring down my bedroom window, and once again, he cuts a path through his lawn, stopping one more time to stare at the dented grass by the side of his house. I'm positive he's about to see me. Even with the trunk providing cover, there's no doubt he'll spot my stupid teal shirt through the camouflage. I brace for my fate, the adrenaline no longer providing me strength. Now all I can do is wait in paralyzed silence to be discovered. But Mr. Peterson doesn't look up. Instead, he walks calmly, almost serenely, through the basement doorway, closing the door with care and methodically locking the bolts that remain in place after the carnage. I wait until I'm sure it's not a trap. I wait for the music that doesn't start up again, for the sound of shoes that don't touch the basement steps, for the cracked window in Aaron's room to open. I wait for a single sign of life in the house that was moments ago alive with the fury of a single hulking monster. Then I come out. I dread climbing the trellis and consider sleeping in my backyard just so I can hide. When I do make it to my room, I push my dresser in front of the window as a barricade. When I wake up the next morning, I feel braver somehow. Maybe it's the light of day creeping in around the sides of my dresser, or the soreness in my arms that reminds me I had enough wits about me to hide behind the tree. Whatever the reason, I lean against my dresser and return it to its place, staring at the house that had terrified me so badly under the cloak of midnight. "You're not so scary," I tell the house and the man inside it, and I almost believe myself until I flinch a little too hard at the sound of scratching just below my window. There, tucked into the trellis propped against the exterior under my bedroom window, is a folded piece of yellow notebook paper, its edges fluttering and scraping the siding in the morning breeze. Retreating back to my room, I rummage through my box of gadgets until I find what I'm looking for, a handy little tool I invented after realizing the tangle of vines on the trellis was where Aaron would be leaving me all my secret messages. I finally find it, the grabber I customized using the extender from a pool broom and the lever from a pooper scooper. Then I return to the window, carefully lowering the grabber and retrieving the paper from the vines. But when I unfold the paper to read its message, I feel even worse than I did when I woke up on the floor. He's getting worse. I look out the window across the street and wait for the messenger to make themselves known, but I know it's no use. It appears they left behind more than a note, though. From the ground, a glinting catches my eye. I squint to see what it is, but the sun reflects off its surface and I can't make it out. "Guess I'm climbing you again after all," I say to the trellis, which groans under my weight. At the bottom of the trellis, tangled in a thick knot of vines, is a delicate gold chain, a tiny apple charm dangling from its links. A bracelet I've seen before. Something in my stomach hardens as I flash back to another apple, this one made of bronze, dancing in a fountain in the middle of the square. Dancing around the picture of a smiling Lucy Yi, her wrist decorated with an identical golden apple charm bracelet. I turn the bracelet over in my hand and realize there's an inscription on the back. Golden Apple Young Inventors Club. I look up and down the street, but it's no use. Whoever left me the bracelet and the note is long gone. You're not far, though, are you? I say under my breath. I look directly across the street at the Peterson house. Something tells me you're watching me right now. Chapter 10. I own one suit, which is one more than any person should own. The shirt is stiff, the collar itches my neck, the pants feel grandpa high up to my chin, and the shoes are so slippery that I could slide off into the next zip code if I'm not careful. Plus, the suit doesn't even fit. I've grown 2 inches since the last time my parents had it altered, and no matter what I wear it for, I'll only ever remember it as the funeral suit because it's what I wore after my grandma died.
5 minutes, Narf,
Dad says from the other side of my bedroom door, and I can hear his shoes tapping down the hall and back toward my fussing mom. Here, let me get that for you, my mom says.
It's fine, Lou.
You missed 3 belt loops, she says.
I'm trying to expedite my escape from this contraption later on, he says.
Hun, would you please try to act like a normal human for 3 hours? These are my colleagues, Mom pleads. And without even seeing him, I know Dad is looking at the ground and nodding. There's enough guilt to waft in my direction, and I look down too, even though they can't see me. It's for Mom. That's all we need to know about tonight. It's obvious that Ravenbrooks is proud of their university. The main brick buildings are old, but their trims are freshly painted, their landscaping tightly manicured and closely clipped. Tonight's fundraiser for a new sciences wing isn't taking place anywhere near the current sciences wing. I guess the organizers figured jars of pickled animal hearts and emergency eyewash stations didn't create the right atmosphere for a gala. I'm disappointed, though. I'd been hoping to sneak to the library to read the rest of the article I pocketed. Instead, the fundraiser takes place in the main library, the centerpiece of the university, for good reason. Its ornate carvings and meticulously lined shelves are anything but small town. The crystal stemware and white cloth napkins only add to the formality, leaving little doubt about why I'm wearing a suit, even if it is a size too small. Mom is across the room wearing the purple dress that Dad likes because Mom feels good in it. She says it hides her lumpy parts, and Dad says he likes her lumpy parts, and that's when I leave the room for fear of throwing up. But tonight, Mom doesn't look like she's worried about her lumpy parts, or worried about anything, really. She looks like she owns the room. Dad is in a corner chasing a goat cheese ball around his plate with a fork and laughing with some donor Mom pointed out to him. I'm stuffed on goat cheese balls and sparkling grape juice, and I've scoured the shelves, unsuccessfully, for a single book that doesn't look like it would put me in a coma. I'm on my way back from the bathroom when I see the sign with an arrow pointing downstairs to the archives. Archive. References, periodicals, microfiche. I peek around the corner to make sure my parents are still busy talking to the donors before slipping downstairs. The science library didn't have much in the way of city records, but I'm hopeful the main library will offer more. With my parents distracted, maybe I'll actually have a chance to read a full article this time. The stacks are piled with newspapers dating back 20 years, when the Ravenbrooks banner was simply the bulletin. I learn that Mrs. Bevel, who owns the creepy doll shop, actually has a degree in doll making. I also learn that doll making is a college degree. I discover that my street was one of the first streets developed in Ravenbrooks, and that our very own, not our own, turquoise house was previously home to a Hollywood stunt woman.
Mrs. Tillman once had to recall a batch of the Survive a Cocoa Bars that give Aaron and me the farts because the manufacturer found a dead gopher in the chocolate vat. The former mayor of Ravenbrooks was impeached for lying about his legislative experience. The llama farm, indeed, used to have goats. Overall, I learned that Ravenbrooks has always been as boringly strange as it is today. By the time the bulletin had become the Ravenbrooks banner, the news seems to have slowed. Store openings and closings and local weather mainly dominated the headlines. That is, until the Golden Apple Factory arrived. Suddenly, Ravenbrooks was booming with activity, and the outskirts of town transformed from farmland to houses to serve the needs of the factory workers and their families. And the town grew even more with the explosion in popularity of the Golden Apples, which at first was only a local candy.
"Who would have guessed a local favorite would become a national obsession?" raved one executive of the Golden Apple Corporation in a story dated 5 years ago.
"I like the chocolate ones best," declared a kid from the same article, pictured with his mouth ringed in said chocolate. Pretty soon the factory grew to a storefront, and they began giving tours. Interactive exhibits became lures for out-of-towners, and a new hotel sprung up on Market Street. Then the announcement came. The Golden Apple Corporation would be building a multi-million dollar theme park right here in Ravenbrooks, where it all began. Every week, at least one story above the fold boasted the progress of the park's construction. I keep reading in morbid fascination. I can't help myself. It's like when magazines publish pictures of Pompeii with their homes and markets frozen in time, unaware that life would come to a sudden stop. I thumb through page after page of pictures featuring different parts of the park. It's like there was no other news in town for 2 years. I flip the page of one newspaper dated September 14th, 1991, which features a crew unwrapping a shiny new carousel, its glitter and bright blues and reds stark against the dirt ground and surrounding trees they hadn't yet cleared. I set the paper aside and pick up another from the following week. Predictably, there's another Golden Apple amusement park story, this one featuring the half-constructed front entrance. There are at least a dozen workers in their safety vests hauling a sign into place. The next week's paper captures a cement mixer pouring concrete, and this time several small kids gather around the scene, oversized hard hats obscuring all their faces. The next week's article pictures the unraveling of a tarp decorated with shiny gold apples and men and women in suits smiling down at the design. Finally, I come to the week of August 7th, 1992, the headline reading in all capital letters, "Golden Apple Amusement Park Set to Open." A massive crowd of business people in suits and construction workers in coveralls and photographers in vests and local proprietors in red and gold polo shirts lines the entrance of the park 4 rows deep. Each one holds in their extended hand a palm-sized golden apple. Each one smiles brightly, the possibility of the park's success alive in their imaginations. Only one person doesn't hold an apple. Instead, he holds an almost comically large pair of golden scissors over a red ribbon. He wears a black suit with a red and gold tie, but I recognize him even out of his Argyle sweater. Mr. Peterson. It's the caption of the picture, though, that forms a hard pit in my stomach. Park designed by local engineer Theodore Masters Peterson. I read it 5 more times to be sure, but even without the caption? There's no mistaking the mustached face of Aaron's dad. The following week's paper is almost entirely dedicated to the glory of Golden Apple Amusement Park. The front page lead story tells of opening day successes, punctuated by a collage of smiling parents and ecstatic kids, balloons in hand, and cotton candy webbed between their fingers.
Ravenbrook's banner. Local engineer brings world-renowned talent home. Peterson has designed parks on 6 continents. Read on for a sneak peek of his latest undertaking.
Above the fold is a dapper-looking headshot of Mr. Peterson, his carnival mustache twirled at the ends in perfect theme park designer character. Mr. Peterson is a sort of genius. A physics whiz, he engineered some of the world's most innovative attractions, bringing new technology and gimmicks to nearly every new park he's designed. There was the vacuum-powered food delivery system at the Alberta Avalanche Park. It flies through a tube just like the tellers use at a bank, one patron marveled. There were the robotic vendors at Tokyo's Cherry Blossom Grove. I didn't have to wait in line for hours just to buy a keychain, said another parkgoer. And as his reputation as an engineer grew, so did his ambitions for his parks. Only instead of looking for business innovations, it seems like Mr. Peterson became more interested in the rides themselves. At Berlin's Spannender Spaß Park, he was the first engineer to create a perpetual motion boomerang ride. Ride operators admitted it could only be stopped by a kill switch on a hidden console.
I thought I was going to barf,
remarked one rider, whose laughing face betrayed a hint of panic in his picture. And then there was the Golden Apple Amusement Park, his crowning achievement as an engineer of the world's most exciting attractions. One could only imagine it had to be spectacular. The profile reads, "With the park's unprecedented opening day crowds, we're left wondering what Mr. Peterson has up his sleeve for the big surprise we've come to expect from his parks."
"You'll just have to wait and see next week," Mr. Peterson is quoted as saying. "I'll give you a hint, though. Have you noticed there's no roller coaster in this park?"
The article ends with a reference to the off-limits end of the park, a tarp several stories high, and a show-stopping ride that was sure to put Ravenbrook's on the map. I'm not sure if I set the article down so much as push it away under the shelf, appalled at its ignorance of what's to come. I want to scream at the reporter, the smiling patrons in the pictures, and the gleeful, reckless Mr. Peterson, who set such an unimaginable tragedy in motion. "There you are. Jay, I found him," Mom thunders down the stairs, looking mostly mad, but a little relieved. I act without thinking, ripping the first few articles from each of the following week's newspapers and shoving them into my pocket before tossing the papers to the side. "You made me sweat all over my favorite dress," she says, as she sits down next to the pile of papers I've amassed. "I got bored," I say as an apology. "And the cool thing about Mom is, that's all she needs." "What's all this?" she says, sliding the papers around a little. "I don't know," I say, which is maybe the most honest thing I've said to my mom in weeks. She lifts a few of the pictures to the light, and her mouth becomes a thin line. Then, without saying all the obvious stuff about how sad it is to see what everyone thought the park was going to be, she looks at me and says, "I think this move has been the hardest one yet." There, in the dim light of the library basement, in her purple dress, with its little dark rings forming in the armpits, Mom becomes my new favorite person. It's the first time she's ever said what I've never figured out how to say, that after a while, calling so many places home just dilutes the word. And she doesn't like it either. Dad descends the stairs just as Mom and I are coming back up.
"Hey, Narf,"
he says, an apology on his face, even though he wasn't there for what Mom said. Sometimes, Dad just knows.
"I smuggled out some cheesecake for you."
I eat dessert in the car, while Mom and Dad rehash the night and laugh about the boring people. I stare out the window at the weird little town of Ravenbrooks and realize that its definition of home probably changed that awful day at the park a week after it opened. I wonder how many people still feel like they did 20 years ago, or 30, or 50, before the day Lucy Yee died. I wonder how much Aaron thinks his dad is to blame for that. When I get home, I practically tear off my suit and get into my pajamas, but sleep won't come easily. I have more reading to do. I pull the crumpled articles from my suit pocket and smooth them across the floorboards of my bedroom.
Ravenbrook's Banner. GAA Park burns as investigation continues. Peterson's past failures resurface. Yee family demands answers.
The first article appears in an issue published a week after the tragedy. It's Mr. Peterson, but his perfectly waxed mustache is less sprightly, more pointy. And the picture isn't the only thing unflattering about the new profile in the Ravenbrooks Banner. What began as a prayer vigil for young Lucy Yee, the 7-year-old victim of Golden Apple Amusement Park's daredevil roller coaster Rotten Core, ended in a fire that devastated the already infamous attraction. Now investigators are demanding to know why the dangerous roller coaster was allowed to operate before passing certain critical inspections, and angry investors have uncovered troubling details about the man responsible for the park's design. A knock at my door startles me from the story, and I slide the paper under my bed just in time for Dad to pop his head in to say goodnight.
"How about that cheesecake, huh?"
he says, wiggling his eyebrows. "It was pretty epic," I say, trying to recall even tasting it.
"Find anything interesting in the library?"
"Yes." "No," I say, shrugging.
"Want me to leave you alone?"
he says, a hint of a smile creeping through. "Kinda."
"Wish I'd just go to bed?"
he says, determined to make me crack. "Well..."
"Trying to figure out how to tell me nicely to buzz off?"
"Dad!" He won. He broke me. He laughs.
"Goodnight, Narf."
I wait until I hear my parents' bedroom door close before retrieving the article from under my bed. A resurfaced investigation has raised concerns over the reputation of the world-renowned engineer after reporters unearthed details of a 1987 accident in one of the designer's parks in Melbourne, Australia. What was first thought to be an electrical fire due to faulty wiring in Wallaby Wonderland's Tasmanian tunnels was later determined to be an accident caused by a critical flaw in the attraction's braking failsafe. The accident occurred when an empty car jumped the track, sparking a fire that ignited an exposed patch of insulation, killing 4 teens, ages 13 to 17. While investors were found legally responsible, that finding remains disputed, as several questions remain about the safety inspections the park failed to undergo prior to its opening. Said one inspector, "As far as I can tell, no one from my team checked that ride. Not a chance anyone would have given it passing marks without an emergency brake." The inspector joins a small chorus of objectors, some of them investors, accused of trying to deflect blame. But one investor lodged an especially disturbing claim against T.M. Peterson, the park's engineer and mastermind. "He told me about the mechanics once, about his frustration with its limitation. He said safety features tamped the excitement down. He said emergency brakes put a drag on the speed. The man specifically mentioned emergency brakes. But with little evidence and a tragedy half a world away, the Ravenbrook's engineer continued his work, bringing what many believe are increasingly unsafe and possibly illegal practices to his park designs. Designs that may just be to blame for Lucy Yee's death." The other front page I borrowed from the library's archives, the issue from 2 weeks after the accident, avoids the name T.M. Peterson altogether. Instead, it features a window into the life of Lucy Yee, about how she loved her hamster Gerard and played the violin and wanted to be an inventor like Leonardo da Vinci when she grew up. The picture at the bottom of the article shows Lucy, her fringe of bangs, doing little to hide the exuberance in her smile. She's cheek to cheek with two other smiling girls, their arms interlocked like sisters. And with a start, I realize that I recognize the face mashed against Lucy's on one side. It's Maya Peterson. And like sisters. All three girls in the picture have matching bracelets with little gold charms in the shape of an apple. The picture is captioned, "Maya, Lucy, and Maritza, members of the Golden Apple Young Inventors Club." I pull the bracelet that I found beneath the trellis from my desk drawer and hold it up to one of the bracelets pictured on the girls' wrists. It's a perfect match. Chapter 11. I throw a pair of pajamas into my backpack and forego my toothbrush to make space for the audio manipulator. It's built, and all we need now is to add the pre-recorded audio. I survey my bag's contents and decide that pretty much covers all I'll need. Downstairs, as I slip on my shoes, Dad and Mom watch me a little too closely.
"Excited for your big sleepover?" Dad asks.
"Dad," I say, wincing.
"Sorry, your super grown-up, totally not a big deal hangout where you might wear pajamas and might not sleep."
"That's not better," I say. "Just remember to brush your teeth," Mom says. And I swear to the aliens, she can see straight through my backpack to my missing toothbrush. "Uh-huh. And say thank you," she says. She's still irked that the Petersons haven't bothered to come by, but to her, please and thank you are holy words. "I will," I say.
"And solve the mysteries of the universe," Dad says, and Mom gives him a look. "What?
Are you implying that manners and hygiene are impossible requests of our son?"
"Lou, he's 12. He's barely human at this age."
I decide to end things before they get ugly. "I'll say thank you," I tell my mom, and she smiles like she's won. "And I'll ponder the meaning of life," I tell Dad, and he gives me a dorky thumbs up. As I cross the street, I do ponder, but not about life's meaning. I wonder how in the world I'm going to ask Aaron about everything I read in the old newspapers about Golden Apple Amusement Park, about his dad and Maya. Because there's not even a sliver of a chance that I'll be able to stop myself from asking. Mrs. Peterson glides into the room like she's on wheels. I don't even hear her until she's right behind me, a pile of sheets stacked on top of a pillow cradled in her arms. I don't mean to jump. It's just that she surprised me.
Wow. I know I forgot to put on lipstick today, but exactly how frightening do I look?
No, you don't at all. I mean, I just... Nikki, I'm kidding, honey. I have a light step.
Mom's a teacher, but she danced ballet when she was in college,
Maya says as she plunks down on Aaron's bottom bunk.
She even danced at one of Dad's park openings.
No one invited you, Pariah, Aaron says, nudging Maya off his bed. Thank you, Mrs. Peterson, I say, taking the linens from her.
Hmm?
She says, her eyes glazed over like she's distracted.
Oh, you can call me Diane, honey, she says, focusing on me long enough to lightly tousle my hair. I said stop calling me that,
Maya says, shoving Aaron's leg when he pokes her with his toe.
Ow! Your toenails are like knives.
Maya Pariah eats farts and papaya,
Aaron sings, still poking her.
Mom!
Mrs. Peterson, Diane, spreads the sheets across the bottom bunk of Aaron's bed.
Stop calling your sister a pariah, she says, clearly lost in more pleasant thoughts.
She's humming quietly to herself, somehow blocking out the escalating brawl between Aaron and his sister.
So if you eat farts, does that mean you burp farts too? Is that why you always smell so bad?
Maya flushes pink and glances at me.
I do not smell bad, Mom!
But Diane is already on her way out the door. She's moving slowly, though, almost like she's forgotten where the door is. All at once, Aaron and Maya stop arguing, and a sudden silence blankets the room. In that quiet, I can hear the faint song Mrs. Peterson has been humming to herself. Only now, she's practically whispering it, like she's afraid to scare away the memory attached to the tune. Maya follows her, still glowing crimson, but she lands a final solid punch on Aaron's bicep on her way out. I watch her leave. Ever since I saw the photo of her, Lucy, and that other girl wearing the Golden Apple bracelet in the newspaper article, I've been trying to understand what it would mean that the bracelet would find its way into my front yard. I still don't know, but I have a feeling Maya does, which means I'll probably never figure it out. Maya's even less of a sharer than Aaron, if that's possible. As soon as Maya reaches the stairs at the end of the hall, Aaron closes the bedroom door and waves me to his desk. He pulls a drawer open, and rather than take anything out of it, he reaches his hand all the way inside until he's shoulder deep and still reaching. I look at his desk, and it doesn't take me long to determine that what I'm seeing is impossible. Flush against the wall, his desk can't stick out more than a foot and a half. What the... Aaron smiles as he struggles to grip whatever hides in his magical desk. Then he gives up and pulls the whole drawer out, exposing its missing back. We duck down, our heads together, and I understand. There's a hole in his wall. The drawer has a false back. You really are a criminal mastermind, I say, and Aaron chuckles. Then he hauls out his treasure. It's a box full of junk of the very best kind. There are dismantled motors and remote control cars, parts of an old toaster, some speaker wire,
clamps and locks, keys to nowhere, a discarded keyboard, a phone without its faceplate, and at least 3 broken calculators. It's a gadget head's bounty. Holy aliens, Aaron, I say, and he smiles in a way that I haven't seen. I think this is what pride looks like on Aaron. From one weirdo to another, I know how elusive pride can be. It's all stuff I collected from the factory before you moved here. I wanted to make something out of it, except I don't know how. He looks at me. Think you can use any of the parts for your audio synthesizer? The synthesizer! I can't believe I almost forgot. Reaching for my bag, I pull out the finished product, and as quickly as Aaron's face lights up, it dims again, and I realize that maybe he wanted to help me finish it. It's not ready yet, I hurry to explain, and some of the light returns to Aaron's face. No? I shake my head slowly and explain. We still need the recording. He smiles so wide, I think his face might split apart. Fart synthesizer. Power source. Green light means active. Recording. AV interface. An hour later, stuffed on Surviva bars and bloated to the point of bursting, Aaron and I are a mess. I'm laughing so hard I can barely hold the microphone to the, audio source. Every time Aaron lets one rip, we fall apart, rolling across his floor like beetles on our backs. It takes everything in me to gather myself, and I plaster on my most serious face, placing a hand on Aaron's shoulder. Fine, sir, I say. I dare say that was your best work yet. He matches my seriousness, but only for a second, and then we both break. Boys, Mrs. Peterson says, peeking in the doorway, are you planning to come down for pizza at any point tonight, or... Sweet Mary, what is that smell? I laugh so hard, my sides pinch. Aaron swipes the tears from his eyes. Sorry, Mom, he says. We're, performing an experiment, I say. Creating art, he says over me. Then we bust up all over again. Well, whatever you're doing, open a window for Pete's sake, Mrs. Peterson says. That's toxic. Aaron farts, this time accidentally, and I have to bury my face in the bottom bunk to keep myself from laughing to death, or suffocating. Either one is equally plausible. Once we've calmed down enough to choose a series of Aaron's choicest farts for the synthesizer, we're suddenly at a loss for things to do. It's late, but neither of us is tired. Still, maybe out of habit or boredom, we pull on pajamas and take to our bunks, Aaron on the top bunk, me staring at the slats from the bottom. It's not the right time, because no time is the right time. But somehow it seems more possible to talk to Aaron about his dad when I only have to stare at the mattress above me and not at his face. So, I gotta ask, I say, trying to sound casual. No, I don't believe in aliens, Aaron says. Wait, what? Sorry, man. I know it's your, I don't know, religion or whatever, he says. It's not my religion. Then I catch myself, pushing my shock aside. Seriously, how can he not believe in aliens? The proof is overwhelming. I try again to bring up the most awkward conversation ever. So, what's up with your dad, anyway? The silence that follows is painful. I only have myself to blame. It was, perhaps, history's worst segue. What do you mean? Aaron asks. But he's quiet, and his voice doesn't ask, what do you mean, as much as, How much do you know?
I mean, he's pretty intense, I say.
This is excruciating.
At this rate, it's going to take me a week to work up the courage to ask him what I really want to ask him. If Aaron knows his dad is suspected of purposely making rides unsafe, ugh, even thinking it sounds absurd. Still, I can't shake the feeling he wants me to ask him. Why else would he accidentally bring me by Golden Apple Amusement Park?
Aaron shifts in his bunk overhead, and I hold as still as I can so I don't miss a word.
Just ask me what you want to ask me, he says.
And suddenly he does sound tired. He sounds like he hasn't slept in years. It's the old Aaron again, the one I encountered on our first few times hanging out. He's old beyond his years, burdened by something unseen. I've aged him. I weighed him down by bringing up the past, a past he has to know about. Of course he has to know about it.
Why did you want me to know about the park? I ask. And he's quiet for so long, I think maybe he's decided to stop talking to me for the rest of the night.
Then, after a long while, he says,
he was a genius, you know. Like a real Einstein-level genius.
I don't say anything, because I do know that. And I don't want to stop him talking now that he's finally started up again.
I'm not happy Lucy Yee died, he says.
And this takes me off guard, because of course he's not. Who would ever be happy about something like that? Then I remember something else he said to me in this very room. Something he said like a confession, even though I didn't know it at the time. What does make a person bad, then? Being happy when bad things happen.
But he stopped after that,
Aaron said, and I understand now. The accident that killed Lucy also killed Mr. Peterson's career, a career that was becoming increasingly reckless with every new venture. Then, Aaron really does stop talking. Before long, I hear the slow, even breath of his slumber above me. The weight on him has disappeared, at least for now. But it isn't actually gone. The weight has shifted to me, and I wonder how I'll ever fall asleep like him. I lie awake for what feels like an eternity, staring at the slats above my bunk, thinking about how long Aaron's blamed himself for simply feeling relieved. Relief in the form of Lucy Yee's death. When I wake up, the only light in the room emanates from the recording light on the audio simulator. Aaron is still in the top bunk. His snoring is the only clear indication he's even alive. I try to remember the last time I've slept that soundly. Except he's not exactly peaceful. He's twitching, hard, and if I listen closely enough between bouts of snoring, I can hear him begging to the things of his nightmares. No, and don't, and please. I lie there for a moment, trying to figure out what exactly it was that woke me up. I was dreaming again, but this dream didn't start in the cart or in the grocery store at all. This one started in a tunnel. It closed in on me, edging closer and closer to my shoulders and the top of my head, until I began to sink. I dropped to the bottom of something deep and dark, so dark I wasn't sure my eyes were even open. And while I don't remember much after that, I do remember the voice that hissed to me across that deep, dark expanse. I remember the chilling words it whispered to me. Find me. And then I woke up.